Welcome to episode 42 of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I am Daniel Emery Price, and I'm joined by Chad Bird. Chad, how's it going?
Hey, it's great. It's great. Good morning, or good evening, or good day, or whatever time you're listening to this. We've been up a while, haven't we?
Yeah.
We were doing this early today.
We did it early, and then I gave myself some time to wake up, so I would have maybe something to say. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. It's still early. It's very early for me, but not so early that I will forget to tell you that Christ Old Fast is a project of 1517 The Legacy Project, and you can go over to 1517legacy.com and check out all the great things they have there. You can also go over to christoldfast.org and read a bunch of articles, listen to other podcasts, watch some conference media, which is all up on the site now at this point. You can watch all the talks. You can watch Chad's devotionals. I've got a talk on there. There's panels and a bunch of other audio and video stuff from the conference. And if you didn't go to the conference or you haven't checked that stuff out, you should, because all of it's really, really, really good. So that being said, Chad, where are we at in Genesis?
Well, we wrapped up chapter 30 of Genesis last time. We're going to cover chapter 31 today. We've been talking about problems with in-laws. So if anybody out there has ever had trouble with their in-laws in any way, then it's not a new problem. Because Jacob was having some major problems with his father-in-law, which is what chapter 30 was all about. If you listened last time, the deal was that Jacob wanted to go back. He'd been there 14 years. He'd served 7 years for each of his wives, and he was ready to go home. But Laban wasn't ready for him to go home, his father-in-law, because Laban was getting rich. Jacob had like the Midas touch. Everything that he dealt with turned to gold. He was enriching Laban, more or less. And so Laban didn't want to lose him. He wanted him to stick around and receive even more blessings from him, through him. He was basically using his son-in-law, Jacob. So they made a deal, and the deal ends up backfiring, because what Laban does is he gives Jacob all the motley sheep and goats, all the ones that are speckled and spotted and whatnot. And we won't go back into the whole story, but what happens is that even though Jacob's only given a small percentage of the flocks and the herds, these motley animals, they end up outnumbering Laban's over time. So the motley animals increase in number, and Laban's herds and flocks decrease, which is ironic too. I don't think I said this last time, because Laban's name is in Hebrew means white. Laban means white. And so Laban starts out with all of these white animals, far outnumbering Jacob's motley animals. And then he ends up with just a few as Jacob's herds and flocks begin to decrease. So his name, Laban, or White, Mr. White, I guess we could call him, his name becomes emblematic of his loss of wealth to his son-in-law Jacob. Now, as you would expect, as these years were going by, and it's 6 years have passed, because he serves 14 years, and now when we pick up with chapter 31, 6 years have gone by. So he served a total of 20 years in exile with his father-in-law. And over the course of time, as Laban has lost all this, his anger has increased. His sons are upset because they see all of their wealth, their inheritance wealth, disappearing, as you know, falling between their fingers or right into the hand of Jacob. And so it finally reaches a crescendo in chapter 31, and it's time to go. Jacob wanted to leave after 14 years, six more years passed, and now it is definitely time for him to hightail it out of there and to get back into his own country. And so here's how the story starts in beginning of chapter 31. what happens is that Jacob hears Laban's sons talking, and they're talking about how Jacob has taken away all of their father's wealth. And Jacob sees that the attitude of his father-in-law is certainly not friendly anymore. He can't even hide it in his face. It's showing all over his countenance and the way that he treats Jacob, that he's getting more and more upset as he sees his herds and flocks decreasing while Jacob's increase. And not only is that going on, but God tells Jacob this time that it's time to go. Back in chapter 30, after the 14 years had passed, it was Jacob's idea. He'd served the time that he said he would for his wives, and he said he's ready to go back home. Laban convinced him to stay, but this time, it's not Jacob's idea, it's God's. So in verse 3, God tells Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you. So it's definitely time to go because his in-laws are against him, and God himself has told him that it's time to go. So what happens is that he decides that he's going to, first of all, include his wives in this decision. And so he calls them out to where he's taking care of the flocks and the herds, you know, away from any eavesdroppers that might pick up on their conversation. And it is at this point that we learn something new about Jacob's plight. That's one of the things I love about the scriptures is that, like any good body of literature, it doesn't tell us everything right from the get-go. There is certainly a literary quality to the scriptures where, as you read along, you actually learn things that shed light on earlier happenings in the story. And that's what happens here. Because when Jacob calls his wives, Rachel and Leah, he first of all tells them, you know, look, it's obvious that your dad is upset with me because of everything that's happened, even though I have served him faithfully. He says, I served your father with all my strength. And here's where we learn something new. This is verse 7 of chapter 31. He says, yet your father cheated me and changed my wages 10 times. However, God did not allow him to hurt me. Now, we didn't know that before. So it kind of gives you a little bit I guess you might say, a little bit of sympathy for Jacob, even though he's not much of a sympathetic character. Laban is a Scrooge. He's a man who is addicted to greed at any expense. And that's what makes this chapter so interesting, is to see how he reacts when his sin is actually called out, and he ends up turning the tables around and blame shifting and victim blaming and making himself out to be this aggrieved party when it's obvious that he is the one who is guilty here, and he's just mad because God has blessed Jacob so much. But we'll get there in a minute. Anyway, so he's cheated him these 10 times, changed his wages these 10 times. And it's also at this point, as I mentioned in last week's episode, that Jacob lets us in on the fact that his little trick of peeling back the branches, you know, to make the branches spotted and speckled, to make them the animals spotted and speckled, that was actually God's idea. He tells his wives that an angel of God appeared to him in a dream and told him basically what to do. So that was all by divine initiative. He was making these sticks into sacraments, if you will. The word of God told him what to do. So he tells his wives, okay, you know, I've served your dad faithfully. He's been a jerk. He's changed my wages 10 times. God told me what to do to have this reversal of wealth. And then he concludes it by saying, God told him to return to the land of his birth. So that's his argument for his wives. And it's kind of funny because, you know, Rachel and Leah have been at each other's throat. They have been having this baby-making competition, a lot of jealousy, a lot of animosity between these two wives as they struggle to have the husband more than the other one does. But here, they agree. There's no argument here. After they listen to Jacob, they say more or less, hey, it sounds good to us. Let's get out of here because our dad, we don't have any inheritance in our father's house anymore. They say he has sold us and has entirely consumed our purchase price. So they see themselves more or less as their father's possessions, which he sold to Jacob. Sold for 14 years worth of labor. And they conclude by saying, surely all the wealth which God has taken away from our father belongs to us and our children. So do whatever God has said to you. So it's going well so far. Jacob sees it's time to leave. The wives see that it's time to leave. God has put his stamp of approval on this. And just before we pick up the story, I think it's good to pause here for a minute just to reflect upon how things had really turned around. Because Jacob goes into exile. He goes into exile with only the word of God in his pocket. That's all that he had. He leaves empty-handed. He flees from his brother. God appears to him at Bethel in this dream with a whole ladder going from earth to heaven. And all that he gives Jacob is a promise. He promises that he will be with him, that he'll bless him wherever he goes, and that he'll bring him back to the land of his fathers. So Jacob leaves with this word of God in his pocket. And while he's in exile, things go extraordinarily well for him because God blesses him, even though he doesn't deserve it. God nevertheless is with him. God blesses him. He now has more or less four wives, if you count the two maidservants. He has 11 sons because Benjamin's not born yet. And he has a daughter. And now he has all these animals. He has sheep. He has goats. He has camels. So it's another great example of this unexpected act of God, where in a situation in which you would expect to be deprived and impoverished and be lacking completely in blessings, it's in that very context that God blesses his people the most. We saw this in the case of Abraham and Sarah when they were in exile in Egypt. They get enriched by Pharaoh while they're there. It's going to happen again with the Israelites when they're enslaved in Egypt. They leave their exile in the Exodus, laden with the wealth of Egypt. And Jacob's in the same situation. He's been in exile these 20 years. And when he comes back with all this wealth. So God puts his people into situations where you would think one thing would happen because of the outer circumstances, and yet something entirely different happens. It's just it's consistent with God's actions throughout the scriptures. He's always he gives his blessings in those situations in which we least expect them, because that's just the way he works. He's the God who gives to those who seem to be in a situation where they can't receive anything. And he does it because that's who he is. He's a good and a gracious God, and he gives to those who don't deserve it when they expect to receive the exact opposite.
I mean, are you saying that Jacob hadn't done a bunch of things to really bend the hand of God his direction at this point?
Like, well, he had lived such a pious life, hadn't he? Honest, upright.
Dude is a picture of uprightness.
Yeah, let's see. I mean, with the exception of lying to his brother and his father and stealing and being eaten up with all sorts of envy and jealousy, and yeah, besides all that, I think he was a pretty good guy.
Just waiting for those, he's just primed up for those blessings to come.
He is. Yeah, I God was probably every day God looked at Jacob. He thought, man, what a good guy.
It's a man after my own heart right there.
Man after my own heart right there. Yeah, you know, that's as we've talked about several times, that's one of the beauties of the scriptures, is that it reveals the ugliness of sinners, while at the same time revealing the beauty of God's grace toward those ugly sinners. There's nothing that Jacob did, nothing whatsoever he did to deserve the blessings that God lavished upon him. In fact, just the opposite. All that Jacob did really deserved nothing but punishment. And here he goes into exile, and this exile is really completely his own fault because he stole the birthright from his brother. And while he's there, despite everything that he had done, God lavishes these gifts upon him. And as we see, and I'm sure, I'm positive that this is only restricted to Old Testament times. But as we see, when Laban realizes that God has blessed Jacob with all of this, he
is really happy for him.
Angry.
He's really happy for him.
Yeah. Yeah, Laban is so happy.
He's elated. So he's happy. Like, man, I'm so glad you got that God's given you some stuff, bro. That is so good. Like, let's rejoice together.
Yeah, what is that about? What is that about that kind of Labanizing? Let's make a verb out of it. Labanizing when people like Laban see that God has blessed someone who is undeserving, and yet it just irritates them to the core. What's going on there?
Well, that doesn't happen now, Chad.
Oh, that's just that was restricted.
That's
to
the old covenant.
Well, theoretically, if we were living in the Old Testament.
Yeah, it would never happen today. Nobody would be upset because somebody who, you know, was a sinner, you know, that God blessed them. Nobody would have a problem with that. I've never seen any examples of that.
No, it is pretty far-fetched. Pretty far-fetched. I mean, most of the time when someone who is a sinner and really messes up, and then God ends up restoring them and blessing them greatly. I mean, most of the time, other people are just, they can't stop clapping. They're so happy.
Yeah. Yeah. Most of that, in reality, and obviously we're joking here, in reality, what happens is they say, what are you doing out of exile? Like, whoa, what are you doing out of exile?
And
what are you doing?
Go back.
What are you doing with all my stuff? That's how that usually happens. What are you doing with all those blessings outside of exile? No, man, that's not how this works. You messed up. You gotta stay there, and you're gonna just, you're just gonna sit there in the exile corner, and I want you to think about what you've done, long and hard.
Yeah, it. It ultimately is very revealing of how we so oftentimes, even though talk about grace and write about grace and preach about grace, when grace is shown to someone that we think is undeserving, it really gets to us because we are still operating with our default position of rewards and punishments. And we think if someone has messed up that they should bear that punishment. They should sit in a corner and be quiet and think about their sin the rest of their lives. And you know, surely, yeah, they're forgiven, but they certainly don't deserve to receive any kind of good things after what they've done. No. Which just goes to show that, really, it's a denial of what God does in His grace.
It's elder brother syndrome, big time, where it's all these, like, hey, you can't have that because I've actually worked all these years for that. You can't have it. I mean, the elder brother in the parable of the prodigal son is no doubt like, hold up, dad. Let's hear him out. I like this slave idea a lot better. Like, all right, you can come back. I mean, there's forgiveness and everything, but yeah, slave is right. That sounds about right. You come, be a slave, no ring, no robe, none of that stuff. But yeah, you want to come back and we'll forgive you and you can be a slave. That's what you typically have. Because what that person is thinking is, you can't have for free what I think I've earned.
Mm.
That's what it is.
Yeah. That's what it is. Yeah, it's almost as if we have taken the idea of purgatory, and we've shifted it to this life, where the idea is that if someone has sinned like Jacob did, or someone sins today, they've got to be purged of that sin through a period of suffering. And as often happens, we think that we're the ones to determine how long that period should be before they're finally free to enter into the full embrace of God's goodness. But until such a time, then they need to bear the penalty of purging. And then once they've demonstrated that they've suffered enough, then we'll welcome them back.
Common tale.
Yep. Happens every day. So that's where our friend Laban is at. So let's pick up the story. Verse 17. So here's what they come up with. Here's their plan. First of all, they pick the perfect opportunity. They pick the time when Laban is away shearing his sheep, which was a very, very involved task. It took a lot of time. It took a lot of people. And so Laban was distracted by all the activities that involved shearing his sheep. So they pick that particular time, and Jacob and his wives, they pack up everything. Put the kids and the wives on camels. They drive away their livestock, everything that they've acquired in exile. They get together and they prepare to leave so that no one will realize what's going on. Laban is too distracted at the time to realize what's happening. And then we'll pick this up in just a minute. But one more detail is added, which becomes significant in a few days. Because it says that Rachel stole the household idols that were her father's. That's the English translation that I'm reading from. The Hebrew is teraphim, that phrase household idols. Teraphim occur other places in the scriptures, and we're not told exactly what these teraphim were, but probably some kind of small idols that Laban had. We know they were small because she could hide them under her camel saddle. And we don't know why he had them. I mean, did he worship them? Did he use them for some kind of, you know, consultation of the gods? Or maybe they were supposed to be there for household protection. Who knows what it was? But he had these teraphim, which is probably... It's probably a phrase that's intended to be an insult against these idols, because it either comes from the verb to mean that means to be limp or without energy, or it comes from a verb that means to decay or become foul. We see this a lot of time in the scriptures. The scriptures won't call them gods or won't call them idols. It'll call them like worthless things, or shame, or pellets of dung, or futilities, or shameful things. That's the way the scriptures often speak of these false gods, as in a pejorative sort of way. So these teraphim, these limping things, or these worthless things, she stole those. Now, why? Well, we're not told why she did it. Did she do it to spy at her father because she knew it would make him mad and she was mad at him? If he used these for some sort of divination, then maybe she thought, oh, if I take his gods, he won't be able to tell where we've gone. We really don't know, but she took them. She stole the household idols that belonged to her fathers. And as we'll see in just a minute, that ended up being a problem in a few more days when Laban catches up with them. So they take off. He flees with all he has across the Euphrates River and heads toward the hill country of Gilead. And I just love how we see here, as we see other places too, this Exodus motif pop up again. This is an exile, just like the Israelites were in exile. They leave, they cross a body of water, the Red Sea, and they set their face for the Holy Land. Here Jacob leaves, he crosses the Euphrates River, and he sets his face toward the hill country of Gilead. So what Jacob experiences, he experiences in his own person what his people will experience later on in their exodus from Egypt. But they don't get very far before Laban finds out what's happened. They get a 3 days journey ahead, and then Laban hears what's happened. And he gathers all his kinsmen together, and he sets off in hot pursuit. It takes him a few days. It takes him 7 days to catch up with them, but he does in the hill country of Gilead. And Laban is mad. In fact, he's so angry that he's ready to do them physical harm because he has lost not only his family, but he's lost his moneymaker. He's lost Jacob. I think he was much more upset over Jacob leaving than he was over his daughters. But he wants to get back what's his, at least what he thinks is his. But God stops him. This is in verse 24. So he overtakes them. I guess he camps for the night. He's gonna pursue them. He's gonna come face to face with Jacob the next day. But that night, God comes to him in a dream and says, "Be careful that you do not speak to Jacob either good or bad." So right before Laban is ready to attack, right before he's ready to seek revenge against his son-in-law, God stops him, warns him, tells him to be careful about what he's about to say or what he's about to do, because Jacob is under God's protection. So the next day, Laban catches up with Jacob, and he has this speech, and this speech is just priceless because it goes with what we were talking about earlier. Laban is a perfect example of a sinner who is unwilling to accept responsibility for his actions. And instead, he tries to turn everything around to where Jacob is the one to blame, and he himself is innocent. Jacob is the one who has deceived and tricked him, and Laban is completely innocent in this regard. So he tries to switch everything around to where it's Jacob's fault, and he himself becomes out to be the aggrieved party in everything that's happened. So he begins by saying in verse 26, "What have you done by deceiving me and carrying away my daughters like captives of the sword? Why did you flee secretly and deceive me and didn't tell me so that I might have sent you away with joy and with songs, with timbrel and with lyre, and did not allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters? Now you have done foolishly." So Laban is painting himself as this kind father and grandfather and father-in-law who is just heartbroken over the fact that his family has left him without him being able to shower this paternal affection upon them. He makes himself appear as if really what he cared about the most was the loss of his family. Even though, according to Jacob's own testimony, and according to the testimony of Laban's own daughters, he didn't give a crap about them. He had sold them off. He had gotten rid of them. He had taken away their inheritance. All he cared about was his wealth.
There's something like awesome about Laban being like, "I tell you, Jacob, I mean, it's all fun and games, but when you start playing tricks with family members, it's messed up, man. It's messed up. I mean, you know, sacramental sticks and spotted sheep and everything. I mean, it's all good. But you start, like, you know, we start playing tricks using people, like using my daughter specifically. It's low, man. Like, I would never do something like that." What? I mean, can you imagine this conversation? Seriously? I mean, I just can't believe that you would do this, man.
I would never, never act deceitfully with my own daughters.
Never. I've always done right by them. You know this, man. Oh, man. The blindness of, like, oh, man. I know my name means white, but I'm about to go pot calling the kettle black here.
You got to wonder if Laban is one of those people, and you've probably met him too, where it is so patently obvious that they're lying, but they have lied so long that they've actually convinced themselves that the lie is the truth. Is that going on with Laban, or is he just a smooth talker? You know, he's just one of those that always act as if he's got everything under control and he's in the right and everybody else is in the wrong.
being like a pro deceiver as Jacob is, though, but Jacob's got to be like, yeah, man.
Whatever. I'm going to call BS on all this.
Yeah, man. All right.
Yeah, this is really this whole story has been like the Olympics of deception, where you have Laban and you have Jacob both vying for the gold. And it goes back and forth. You know, Jacob will pull into the lead. Oh, then Laban, he pulls into the lead. Then Jacob pulls into the lead.
Laban's trying real hard to, like, stick this dismount, but I don't think Jacob's buying it.
I don't think he is either. Yeah, so he's got all these complaints. He's been deceived. You haven't let me send my daughters off like I really wanted to. I couldn't kiss them, and we couldn't have this party, this farewell party. So he's done all of, he says all of this, but then he saves the best for last. So, you know, he makes himself out to be just heartbroken over all this. And he, at the very end of his speech to Jacob, he saves the real zinger. And I think this is ultimately what his anger is all about, because his final words to Jacob in the speech are, "And why did you steal my gods?" That's the last thing he says. So he makes himself out to be this heartbroken victim. But then at the end, you can almost see this change in his countenance, where he looks Jacob in the eye and says, "Oh, and by the way, why did you steal my gods?" He was saving what he thought was his strongest argument for last.
Or maybe just the only legitimate complaint.
Yeah, or maybe the right.
He's like, "I know all of this stuff is like total baloney, and I'm being I'm like just the rankest hypocrite ever as I dish out all these accusations, but I'm saving the best for last because in reality, it is kind of messed up that you stole my gods."
Yeah, I do have one thing going for me, no matter what you might say about everything else. You stole my gods. And it is so humorous that he says what he says, because stealing gods, I mean, is this god napping?
Yeah.
How could you steal gods? If your gods are capable of being stolen, then those gods are certainly unable to protect you if they can't even protect themselves from being stolen.
If your god can be stolen, I suggest you just pawn it.
Yeah. Get what you can out of it, buddy, and move on. You got to find some better gods.
For real.
Can't even protect themselves from being stolen and stuck under a camel saddle. What pitiful, disappointing deities those must be. But that's the accusation. So how does Jacob respond? Well, Jacob, first of all, says, "Well, this is why I left." He says, I was afraid, because I said, lest you would take my daughters from me by force." I'm not sure about how forthright Jacob is being here.
No.
Because he never said before he was afraid. And he never said that he was afraid that Laban was going to take his daughters away from him.
No, Jacob is just like a dude that slips away in the night, because that's the kind of dude he is.
Yeah. Yeah, this is like matching lie for lie. Laban lies, and then Jacob responds falsely as well. But then he goes on to say, and Rachel had to have been a little bit nervous when she heard Jacob saying this. He says, "The one with whom you find your gods shall not live." So he says, "In the presence of all of our family, I tell you what, you point out what is yours and my belongings and take it for yourself." And then we have this new revelation thrown in, that Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen the gods. So Jacob, he probably thinks this is a made-up accusation too, you know, because Laban was lying about everything else. He's lying about the theft of the gods as well, because he didn't realize that Rachel had indeed stolen these pitiful deities. So we have this humorous search that Laban does. He goes into everybody's tent. He starts with Jacob's tent. Then he moves to his daughter's tent. And he goes to the maidservants, and he's like feeling around all over in the tent because he's sure, he certainly is going to find these gods. And you can just kind of see Jacob and all his family just standing back over there. They got their arms crossed. They're looking at him. They're looking at each other like, yeah, what a jerk. You know, he's not going to find anything. And then he finally comes to Rachel. And this is my favorite part of the story, because she says to her father, she's sitting on the camel, okay? She didn't dismount. She's sitting on the camel. And she had taken the gods, and she'd put them in the camel's saddle. So that's where they are. And when Laban, her father, comes to her, she says, don't be angry, Dad. Let not my Lord be angry, for I cannot rise before you, for the manner of women is upon me. In other words, I'm on my period. So here she is, sitting on the camel, telling Laban that she's on her period, and the gods that he's searching for are underneath her. Now, what's great about that is whether she was really on her period or not, or whether she was just making that up, the thought in the Old Testament of gods coming into contact with a woman who was menstruating would have been of the utmost insult to the gods. We know from Leviticus and other parts of Scripture that when a woman is on her period, that she's considered ritually unclean. And so, for instance, she couldn't come into the tabernacle or the temple until her period is over and she cleanses herself. But here is the image of these gods sitting directly beneath Rachel while she tells her father that she is menstruating. So it's like an added insult to the fact that these gods were so inept that they were stolen in the first place. Now they're beneath Rachel while she's on her period. So he searches, and of course he doesn't find the gods. And at this point, Jacob gets angry. And he goes back over everything that Laban has done to him. It's verses 36 and following. He tells him how long he served with him, everything that he suffered, how much Laban has taken away from him, but how God is the one who has stood by his side and has reversed the fortunes and taken from Laban everything that actually now belongs to Jacob. So there's really nothing that Laban can do at this point. It's obvious that he can't find the gods, that his own family has come to realize that he is not for them, and that God is on their side and is bringing them back from exile. So the conclusion of all this is that basically they decide, well, let's at least make a treaty. And that's what the rest of the chapter is about. Laban says, well, let's set up this rock. Let's set up this pillar, this heap of stones, and let's make a treaty that I'm not going to cross it to harm you and you won't cross it to harm me. Jacob says, I'm good with that. Let's do that. They make an oath. They swear by God's name. They have a meal, a sacrificial meal, and they basically decide that this is going to end it all. Laban's going to go home. We're going to continue on our journey. We're not going to be at war with each other. We're going to go our separate ways. So that's the way that the chapter ends. And it's a great story, like so many of the biblical stories, because it gives us such an insight, not only into the self-serving aspect of human nature, which we see in Laban, but more importantly, it gives us one more insight into the gracious action of God on behalf of his children. Here you have undeserving, sinful, deceitful Jacob, who is laden with all these blessings that God has given to him, even though he is undeserving. So God goes with him in exile. God protects him in exile. He blesses him in exile. And he's bringing him home, and it's all by grace, because Jacob has deserved the exact opposite. But that's the kind of God we have. He gives to the undeserving.
That's it. That's it. And we're out of time, Chad.
We got 40 minutes is up.
We got to leave it right there, guys. Hey, if you enjoyed 40 minutes in the Old Testament, you can go over to ChristHillFast.org and know that you can make a donation because this is listener-supported stuff. So you can, and we'd appreciate it. And if you have, thank you very much. We will be back next week to see, I think there's some more of this.
There's a little bit more of this, and we get to this very exciting episode of Jacob wrestling with the angel.
Yeah, wrestling out your blessing. All right, we'll see you then.